The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Some of you probably think that Reverend Master Jiyu was the founder of this temple. But he was only impersonating Koho Zenji. And one never starts a temple in one's own name, because it's out of gratitude for the teaching that we have received that we create a place to train for others. And this was her great purpose in life, was to pass on the teaching that she had received. And she did it very well. I hope she did it very well. Koho Zenji was born in 1879. And August 16th, he was ordained when he was 11 years old, and transmitted in 1901 by his teacher, who also had adopted him. He had an extensive career in the priesthood, but he also established schools for women, both kindergarten through college courses. For 200 years, women were suppressed and not allowed an education in Japan during the Tokugawa era. And it was his great wish that the women be allowed to have education. And in 1957, he became the abbot of Sojiji. And in December of 1960, he was the goodwill ambassador commemorating 100 years of friendship between Japan and America in a tour of Europe and America at the age of 82. We have pictures here on the back wall of his meeting President Eisenhower. And President Eisenhower knew it was polite to sit down when you met an important Japanese person, and Koho Zenji knew it was polite to stand up when you met an important American person. And so Eisenhower sat down and Koho Zenji sat. They were about the same height at that point. And then they reversed, and then they finally got it together to both stand up and shake hands. And so, and it was his opportunity to ask the head of the country for permission to spread Soto Zen in America, because in Buddhism it's always polite to ask the ruler of the country if it's okay to do this. And we know that the unhappy event of Bodhidharma going to China and not having great success with the emperor. Reverend Master had very little contact, actually. She met him because she was, when he got to England on this trip, she was in charge of arranging for his places to talk and his schedule over there. And he wasn't allowed to meet the Queen in England. He was allowed to meet the Foreign Secretary. And in the course of arranging the talks, his talks, he asked her what she would like to do with her life. And she said, well, you know, I've always wanted to be a monk. And he said, come to Japan and be my disciple. So she did. And there's this a couple of instances I will read about from her diary. This is a little incident where she had been taking care of who she calls Reverend Sanzaburo, when after he had had a stroke, and she said, just before he was about to be taken to the hospital after many days of taking care of him, she said, I was sitting in the far corner watching Reverend Sanzaburo's wife preparing him for the journey and wondering if I would ever see him again alive. Zenji Sama knelt down besides Reverend Sanzaburo and said something quietly to him. I'm not sure I can say this without crying. And then he turned around to face me and said, "Thank you." In Japanese, in such a loud voice, clear and young sounding voice, that it sounded as if to echo off the walls of the room. Again, I experienced the same piercing, gentle glance that he had given me during Jukai. And the same physical thrill as when he contrived to touch my hand during the ceremony. He turned and left the room, and it was as if the sun had gone. And this was some months later. Since the Americans came yesterday, my loneliness has become all the more poignant, all the more obvious. I didn't realize how much I enjoyed seeing them. This afternoon, I decided that I had better try to do something about this, and the only thing that I could think of was to go and tell Zenji-sama. It seemed an unimportant thing to see him about, but I really didn't know what else to do. However, I knew that the only way I could get through to see to him was if we were to take him a present, since I wanted to see him officially. That would be the only way I would get past all his assistants. So I went out and, knowing he loves goldfish, bought the largest and most beautiful fantailed fish I could see. Didn't cost an awful lot, only 300 yen, which is about 6 shillings. I went to Zenji-sama's house with a chubby fish in a plastic bag. There was much bickering with the assistants, but I insisted that since I had a present for Zenji-sama, I had a right to see him. And what was more to the point, intended to do so. After a long argument with me, pointing out that Zenji-sama was, at least officially, my master, whether they liked it or not, I was permitted to go into the garden and look at him through the window. Zenji-sama, apparently feeling that this was not quite right, kindly opened the window and came out smiling gently. As a result of all the bickering and argument, I began to stammer in really atrocious Japanese, and with one eye over my shoulder at the scowls of his assistants, that I had brought him a present. "I have brought you the most perfect fish I could find for your pond," I said. He flashed me a lovely smile. "But a perfect fish cannot live in the pond with other fish." "So I will keep this one in a bowl in my room until it becomes less perfect." So saying, he took the bag and disappeared back into his room again. I'm not sure how long I stood in the garden staring at the closed window, but it must have been for some time, for I came to myself came to myself again to hear the chief assistant asking me just how long I intended to stay there. And it was as though my mind had been turned inside out. Here was I, trying to be absolutely perfect according to the precepts, terribly earnest, sincere almost to the point of morbidity in some ways, trying to explain how to live completely and utterly by the precepts and completely and utterly by one's own heart. Sitting in the meditation hall every morning, getting there before anyone else did, with this attitude of mind, "Beat me, I need it. I've been so bad in the past," and wondering why everyone else avoided my company. A thought flashed through my head, but it doesn't really matter what they think. What matters is that I'm as perfect as I can be. What Zenji-sama said had definitely shaken something loose inside of me, though. I bowed to the assistant and left the garden. I didn't go to the meditation hall this morning. I stayed in bed. Just before breakfast, I got a telephone call from an irate senior assistant in Zenji-sama's house. After scolding me soundly for not being at meditation, he informed me that Zenji-sama had accorded me the unprecedented honor of wishing to drink tea with me. Since I had not been to the meditation hall, he, the assistant, could not possibly understand why. On reaching the house, I was not at all surprised to find Zenji-sama standing by his goldfish pond, holding the fish that I had brought him in a bowl. "Let's put this fish into the pond before we drink our tea," he suggested, and together we emptied the contents of the bowl into the pond and watched the fish scuttle away. We went indoors to have tea and cakes, and when we had finished, he said, "I expect you in the meditation hall in the morning." "I shall be there, Zenji-sama," I replied. "Afterwards, may I help dig up the weeds in your garden?" "With pleasure. I will come and help you myself," he said. I bowed and I left him. The question and answers we had exchanged were exactly what I felt they should be. They were part of what went on yesterday, and they are the answer to my question about loneliness. What he had really said, especially in the last part with regard to the weeds, is strive for perfection within, but don't make a parade of your striving so that the world shall call you holy. I've been trying so hard. I'm sure that's why they are so unfriendly. I must always be sitting still in the meditation hall within my own heart and not making a show of being in the physical meditation hall. I must appear at all times to be quite natural. Wrong deeds, words, and thoughts, they are the weeds, and they must be rooted out. But since neither master nor disciple are perfect, there is something which we must do together and not separately. And if I'm a wise disciple, while honoring my master as my teacher, I must not copy his mistakes. And I must recognize that he, like me, can make them. I mustn't become attached to perfection, so attached that no one wants to be with me. That's how I understand what he was saying. When I went to see him yesterday, I felt as though I was all tied up with wire, and now I'm almost shaken loose again. I'm back to where I was long ago, the day that I knew the bucket of water was completely clean. Always will be, and always was. Very often I remember the part about the goldfish, but not about the weeds. This is a book that Koh Zenji had translated so that the Americans who came to Sojiji after the war would be able to have something in English that they would understand. And my favorite quote in here is that if you can give up something as small as the self, you can know something as great as the universe. But there's a paragraph I came across this morning that I want to read. We can arrive at selflessness only by robust faith. Desire for personal gain is nothing more than the dictates of your lustful self. Selflessness, on the other hand, does away with the distinction between oneself and others and achieves a fundamental unity, rich in all-embracing compassion, which makes us vow to accept all things, rejecting none. This vow is truly a manifestation of the heart of Buddha. At the same time that the Buddha transcends us, he is embracing us. We are never apart from that which is, and it's only our willingness to accept our limitations that we can transcend them.